T-Biz Podcast delivers tea news that you need to know. A recap of the week's major headlines with commentary and cultural trends hosted by Dan Bolton. It is the voice of origin for tea professionals and enthusiasts worldwide.
Tea nourishes and inspires. It is an ancient plant-based medicine that heals and energizes the body while soothes the mind. Transforming the leaf requires a fusion of artistry, craftsmanship, and commerce. The tea trade is fundamentally local, yet exerts a global influence, generating $260 billion in sales and employing millions to enhance the well-being of all. Hello, everyone. Here are this week's headlines. Brutal tariffs disrupt global trade norms. A study recommends Pakistan pursue a local tea revolution. And Wong Bakri is once again named India's most trusted tea brand. Plus, tea advances from the ground up. The United Nations Industrial Development Organization announced on March 25th the first of five lighthouse demonstration projects funded by the UK's Accelerate to Demonstrate. Biomass gasification is among the most promising options for tea, as it can reduce emissions, lower energy and cultivation costs, improve fertilizer efficiency, and increase productivity. The Kenya project, led by Compact Syngas Solutions and supported by CoRegen Sapeva and the International Institute of Tropical Agriculture, utilizes technology critical to greening the tea industry and documenting a scalable path for industrial decarbonization. Joining us today from London is CoRegen co-founder and CEO Artie Shaw. We discuss the challenges in the tea industry, focusing on innovation, oversupply, and regeneration. Artie emphasized the importance of systems thinking, collaboration, soil health, and modern technology such as gasification and biochar for its potential to improve soil quality. We also discuss the need for government policies that promote tea and foster a strong consumer-driven business culture. More in a minute, but first, this important message.
What happens when businesses along the tea supply chain get together and support women and children in tea communities? The Mother and Child-Friendly Seal for Responsible Business is creating long-term positive impacts, making your cup of Ceylon tea all the sweeter. Learn more at srilanka-motherandchildseal.org.
The U.S. imposed 61.5% tariffs on Chinese tea this week, marking a 34% increase over previous highs. Double-digit levies on tea imported from Japan, India, and Vietnam will result in American consumers paying significantly more for their daily cup of tea. China, India, and Japan shipped 70,000 metric tons of tea to the U.S. in 2024, collectively accounting for 53% of the country's tea imports. Every business globally will now incur a 10% duty on products shipped to the U.S. Higher tariffs in the mid-20s were applied to 60 nations, 25 of the world's top tea trading nations, and every major tea re-exporter are on that list. Vietnamese tea exporters will pay duties of 46%. Sri Lanka will pay 44%. Thailand, 36%. And Taiwan, 32%. Switzerland faces 32% tariffs on shipments of Nest tea, as well as bagged and loose-leaf teas. India, a country that imposes 128% combination of taxes, tariffs, and fees on imported tea, will face 27% U.S. tariffs. South Korea faces a 26% tariff. European Union member countries, including Germany, France, Belgium, and the Netherlands, will be subject to a 20% tariff. Tariffs on UK tea were set at 10%. Argentina will also incur the 10% minimum. Canadian tea sellers who comply with the USMCA trade agreement were spared, one of the few products globally to remain duty-free. quote, Prime Minister Carney has not yet announced what Canada's response will be to the tariffs imposed on Canada. That is expected in the next day or two, end quote, writes Shabnam Weber, president of the Tea and Herbal Association of Canada. Weber said she has asked the Canadian tariff on imports of U.S. tea, herbs, and extracts be removed from the country's retaliatory tariff list. China and the European Union vowed to retaliate when confronted with rates far harsher than expected. More than 20% of EU exports end up in the U.S., but only 8.3% of China's exports are shipped to the U.S. U.S. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent said retaliation would result in further increases. Stock market indexes plunged globally, reflecting investor concerns that tariffs will add to inflation and reduce corporate profits. Economists warn that tariffs will increase the cost of imported goods. The New York Times reports that, quote, the sharp reaction suggests that the scale and scope of the tariffs had come as a surprise to investors, end quote. Rather than unraveling globalization, countries reeling from economic warfare are redirecting trade flows among themselves. Business Insight. As the new rates take effect, American tea lovers who paid $15 for a 250-gram pouch of tea shipped from Vietnam last week will now pay $21.90, which includes an additional $6.90 in duties. The same 250-gram pouch of tea from China will cost $24.25, including $9.23 in duties. Retailers and wholesalers may absorb the 10% tariffs imposed on most countries, but with duties ranging from 20 to 60%, they are more likely to pass the cost along to consumers, potentially slowing the economy and even triggering a recession. TBiz correspondent Rupak Goswami filed this report on Pakistan, one of the world's largest tea consumers. It finds itself at a crossroads. Despite its deep-rooted tea culture, the country remains heavily reliant on imports, consuming approximately 360 million kilograms of tea in 2023, valued at $535 million. As economic pressures mount and foreign exchange reserves dwindle, a fundamental question has arose. Can Pakistan cultivate enough tea domestically to reduce its dependency on international suppliers? Pakistan has experimented with tea cultivation for decades, but efforts to scale up production have been limited. A study conducted by Noman Antik of the International Institute of Islamic Economics at the International Islamic University in Islamabad suggests that strong policy framework combined with research and development is necessary to jumpstart local tea production. Planting regions like Munsara and Hazara could meet Pakistan's growing tea demand, stabilize its economy, and reduce its global debt, ensuring long-term agriculture and economic stability. Quote, Hazara, Abbottabad, and Munsara show great potential for tea cultivation due to their favorable climate. Expanding domestic tea production can be achieved through government incentives, research in disease-resistant tea plants, farmer training, and private sector involvement, end quote, Atik told TBiz. Local production was 15,000 metric tons in 2022 and 23, primarily in Munsara and Hazara. The study notes that although climatic conditions are ideal for tea farming, the sector is hindered by small land holdings, poverty, and a lack of government incentives. To tap its full potential, experts suggest expanding tea cultivation across 150,000 acres in Munsara and Swat districts. Quote, achieving this would require a comprehensive policy framework that includes the distribution of quality nurseries, fertilizers, tea processing units, and improved irrigation systems. Moreover, educating farmers on modern water management techniques and efficient use of resources would be crucial for boosting productivity, end quote, according to the study. Noman emphasized that by focusing more on domestic production, Pakistan can reduce its international debt, stabilize its economy, and become self-sufficient in tea production. Quote, in addition to supporting the agricultural industry, this change will enhance the country's long-term economic stability, end quote, the study concludes. Wagh Bakri has for the fourth year ranked first in loyalty and trust among India's tea brands, according to market research firm Trust Research Advisory. TRA ranked the 133-year-old firm second among beverages in the food and beverage category and first among tea brands, topping Tata, Lipton, and Gernard Tea. TRA's Brand Trust Report is an annual study that evaluates India's most trusted brands based on comprehensive consumer research. This marks the fourth consecutive year the company ranked first in its category among more than 1,000 Indian brands. CEO Sanjay Singhal expressed gratitude for the honor, saying, quote, trust is at the heart of everything we do at Wagh Bakri. For over a century, we have been committed to delivering the finest quality tea, and this recognition reaffirms the faith that growers of customers place in us, end quote. Founded in 1892 in South Africa, the family-owned company is a year older than Lipton. Sri Narandas Desai relocated his brand in Gujarat in 1919, where it quickly spread through the populous north and central states of Punjab, Delhi, and Maharashtra. The tea was a favorite of Mahatma Gandhi, who befriended Desai in Africa. Desai's three sons expanded the business, which has operated as a bulk producer until 1980, when the company began packaging tea. The tea is now sold in 60 countries and 24 Indian states. Paras Desai, executive director, oversees 53 tea lounges with plans to, quote, serve quality tea in every corner of the world through retail and quick service restaurant formats, end quote. The global market is growing at a rate of 10% per year, and authentic chai is in high demand, he says. Revenue was $268 million in 2024. The company employs 1,063 workers and produces 58 million kilos of tea annually. Business Insight. Even the most seasoned marketers believe that trust is a very stable factor in a brand's achievement. However, nothing could be further from reality, says TRA CEO N. Chundramouli. While trust is difficult to build, it is quite easy to lose depending on a brand's actions and communication, or lack thereof. This is evidenced by the brand performances in this year's study, with 324 brands improving their rank positions from the previous year, while 349 brands fell in rank, and 326 others either exiting from last year or entering new markets this year, he writes. And now, a word from this week's sponsor.
Hi, I'm Nish. I grew up in an organic tea farm and I founded Nepal Tea Collective in 2016. Tea is not just a beverage for me, but a catalyst for social change, sustainably empowering hardworking artisans like my parents for the past 30 years. I'm on a mission to make the whole world aware of the goodness of Nepali teas and the good that comes from supporting growers in this remarkable land. If you haven't tasted Nepali teas yet, you're missing out. Our award-winning teas are making headlines. Find out why. Visit Nepal Tea Collective's website to get a free sample of this extraordinary taste of the Himalayas. That's nepalteacollective.com. Or just send me an email at nish, N-I-S-H, at nepalteacollective.com. Cheers.
The United Nations Industrial Development Organization announced on March 25th the first of five lighthouse demonstration projects funded by the UK's Accelerate to Demonstrate. Biomass gasification is among the most promising options for tea, as it can reduce emissions, lower energy and cultivation costs, improve fertilizer efficiency, and increase productivity. The Kenya project, led by Compact Syngas Solutions and supported by CoRegen Sapeva and the International Institute of Tropical Agriculture, utilizes technology critical to greening the tea industry and documenting a scalable path for industrial decarbonization. Joining us today from London is CoRegen co-founder and CEO Artie Shaw. We discuss the challenges in the tea industry, focusing on innovation, oversupply, and regeneration. Artie emphasized the importance of systems thinking, collaboration, soil health, and modern technology such as gasification and biochar for its potential to improve soil quality. We also discussed the need for government policies that promote tea and foster a strong consumer-driven business culture. Artie Shaw is a business and policy consultant who helps companies in high and middle-income countries achieve environmental, climate, and social impact. As a former senior executive, Thomson Reuters, she oversaw operations in developed and emerging markets, transitioning products from frontier markets to more developed ones. She is a visionary leader with the skills of a CEO and managing director. Artie graduated from the University of Bristol with French and computer science degrees. She serves as the board chair of Third Horizon Earth and consults part-time for the International Institute of Tropical Agriculture. It's a pleasure to have you on the program, Artie.
Thank you, Dan, for inviting me. I, by the way, am a huge fan of yours. So it's a privilege to be on your podcast.
The decolonialization of tea is well advanced, but it is also clear that revenue from specialty tea is insufficient to sustain an industry comprised mainly of small and mid-sized farms. Somewhere between monoculture and monopoly, there must be a business model that allows the tea industry to profit while paying living wages with enough left over to invest in addressing serious threats such as climate change. Will you offer listeners an overview from the ground up?
Well, first of all, I agree that there has to be a spectrum, right? And both from a producer and a consumer perspective, if you want to be producing a reliable, perhaps sort of homogenous product at a certain price point, or you also want to have producers who are looking at the complexity of a tea, Camellia sinensis based drink, I think there's room for it all. I agree that it shouldn't be either or. But I think regardless of how it is produced and what is produced, I think we do need to start addressing the fundamentals. And let's start with the soil. Right? At the moment, soils generally are degraded, and specifically where tea is grown, especially where synthetic fertilizer has been used over time, those soils have a problem. And I think we would be foolhardy if we didn't start going back to basics and going to the roots, literally and figuratively, and saying, okay, what does the soil need? I do think also that where the processing of tea is concerned, I see that as a huge opportunity to rethink how power and heat are generated and utilized. When people say, yes, let's make the 19th century boilers more efficient, I will push back on that very strongly to say, why in the global south should we continue to use incineration when we have the likes of Diageo announcing that a Guinness brewery in Dublin will be migrating to heat pumps, right? Yes, I understand that power is still very expensive and unreliable in a lot of these tea producing countries, but shouldn't that be part of the roadmap? And that would help mitigate the other monoculture or the other fossil fuel part of the argument. So whether you're in Kenya and you're talking about eucalyptus, or you're in Northeast India and you're talking about coal and or gas. So I really would like to see everybody along the supply chain really to question their own assumptions about what's working. And say, you know, we've got these modern technologies, let's use them. I will say something that might sound counter everything I've just said, insofar as automation is concerned. You know, I do appreciate that tea is grown on slopes in many parts of the world, and therefore has been almost like the last frontier of automation, and I say that word very carefully, not just mechanization. I do think that, you know, it is a plant and that, you know, requires respect and not just sort of tearing the leaf off just because a thumping great machine can go through the bushes and tear off leaves. At the same time, unless we bring about intelligent automation, the average age of a Kenyan tea farmer is already 65. I'll be talking to you in 5 years' time, and goodness knows what the average age will be by then. And so, yeah, again, I do think that when we say, yes, we need to attract young people into agriculture, we need to think very carefully about how we're going to attract them. If you go to a Kenyan tea farm, you may well see somebody using a panga or a machete, or possibly handheld shears, which are motorized. And at the same time, you know, we're working with a company in India which is developing a robot to do both picking of the tea leaf. We are looking at using agrobotics is for pruning. And so whether it's a single level of pruning, as I have typically seen in Kenya today, or the three levels of pruning that you might have in a place like Assam, I think what we have to be thinking about is where do we use technology in a way that creates multiples of benefits, one of which is shared prosperity. I'm not here to change the what is agronomically the best practice. What I am here to change is, how do we make that practice more efficient? As I said, attract young people. And in the case of what we're trying to do, we're not just talking about pruning. We're talking about actually putting in the biochar in the soil at the same time, because we actually have access to the soil while pruning is happening. So I do think that it goes back to what problem do we want to solve? Well, speeding up pruning would be great. Doing it in such a way that it is, that we're able to use the pruning resources for the gasifier, which we can come onto, and then applying the biochar in the soil and then covering the soil with shaved prunings. It's sort of win-win. We're making maximum use of all the natural resources, and it happens to be a robot that's doing it.
I'm so glad you brought up biochar. I've been championing that since the early 2000s. When you talk about improving the soil, you're using modern technology and a fundamental analysis of the soil to understand what's depleted and how to make the soil more alive and enriched. I like biochar because it's a home for little bugs and all the bacteria to live. But I don't see widespread use of it. Why is there not as much biochar in tea as there could be?
Well, I think generally, from what I've understood, there seems to be less research in tea full stop than other crops. I think specifically where biochar is concerned, we've been working very closely in Kenya with TRICAS, the Tea Research Institute of the Chinese Academy for Agricultural Sciences, and their Kenyan counterparts, so the Kenya's Tea Research Institute. There happens to be a program called the Global Low Carbon Tea Initiative, which is the Chinese, Kenyans, the Germans, and FAO. And we are trying to leverage that program to say, let's do some more systematic research on biochar in tea. So our observational findings till now have mirrored what China has found. I mean, China's done a lot more research than what's happened in Kenya. But it's good to know that, our results do overlap. They have also looked at pH, which is something that we haven't yet looked at in Kenya. But my point here is, and again, it goes back to one of the points I keep sort of banging on about, the challenge in a producer country like Kenya is that it's always relying on other people's funds to do any significant research. I think it would be not unreasonable for Kenyans themselves, both public and private sector, to turn around and say, this is a critical part of our economy. It employs a significant number of people. We should also be putting our own funding into this, because if you're waiting for others, as we've seen over the last few weeks, sometimes that pack of cards can just fall over altogether, or it operates at its own pace if it is still there. So I do think that if a country like Kenya, which is clearly a major producer on the world stage, actually does say, yes, you know what, we are going to put funding, then I think that would help. And as I say, Kenya doesn't need to be on its own. Got a separate project going on around integrated pest management. And since the changing climate has already started impacting productivity in Assam, let's pool our knowledge where we have it, but also let's take a bit of ownership ourselves to say, we're going to fund this.
Congratulations on getting the green light for your biomass gasification project.
So, yes, we're delighted to announce that we will be putting up the first CSS gasifier in a Kenyan tea factory. It's a three-year project which is being funded by UNIDO, the United Nations Industrial Development Organization. And that will allow us to put up a lighthouse pilot, which we'll be inviting everybody to come and see.
So how does it work?
So gasification is low oxygen thermal conversion of woody biomass. What does that mean? So that means we would take the likes of tea prunings, but also other high carbon biomass like maize shanks and bamboo and sugarcane bagasse. It has to be reasonably dry, so 15% moisture content. And then we put it into this process called gasification, which means it has very limited oxygen. It's not like burning in full combustion with lots of air, right? So it's in a chamber with limited oxygen. It's at high temperature, around 850 degrees. And out of that, we get a synthesis gas, which is cleaner than natural gas. It's less polluting. And from that gas, we put that through a combined heat and power engine, and we generate heat and power. So tea, very briefly, a CTC factory, 10-15% of the energy it requires is electricity, so electrical power, and the rest is actually thermal. In the case of gasification, we and the CSS gasifier in particular, we would generate enough power for a 2-3-4-line factory. We wouldn't produce enough heat to replace the boilers entirely, but we can reduce the dependency by 15 to 18%. And the heat would be in two ways. One, it could go directly to the boilers, or we could produce hot water at 90, 95 degrees. And then the third product of gasification is where, so the biomass that isn't converted to energy gets converted to biochar. And this is industrial biochar. It's continuously produced. And we would configure the system to produce about 15% biochar. So for every ton of biomass, we'd get 150 kilos of biochar. And that will then go back on the soil. Biochar also does attract carbon credits, which would be another sort of revenue stream. In many ways, it's an old technology, but also a new technology, because it has, CSS has been investing a lot in research and development over the last sort of 17, 18 years. They have a very clean system. They use dry scrubbing. So what I'm trying to say is that their technology is quite advanced, and that's why we're partnering with them.
Tea plants in Kenya are spaced less than a meter apart. Farmers plant between 10,000 and 20,000 bushes per hectare, yielding an average of 2,000 kilos of green leaf per hectare. With an all-time high of 3,739 kilos per hectare in 2004. What's the optimal way to grow tea there?
Tea is grown in catchment areas, right? And a catchment area in Kenya may be 1,300 hectares, 1,800 hectares, or it might indeed be sort of 5,000 hectares. You know, so I think we have an opportunity to look at the cultivation of tea from that perspective, number one. Number two, then, if you turn around and say, well, we're overproducing, and if we use biochar to help fertilizer be more efficient and therefore increase the yield, then what does that mean? We are starting to free up land. And I think, you know, for the longest time, tea has been sort of tightly packed because you've got to get the most out of that acre or hectare or whatever it is that you're growing your tea on. I do think we need to take a step back and say, okay, what is best for, and I like to think of it as a catchment area, right? So a catchment area serving an existing, and that would be, for example, even the KTDA model, right? So KTDA, the factory will be served by farmers within that that area. So if you were to turn around and say, well, out of that 1,800 hectares, let's reduce the amount of tea overall to X, let's use intercropping for its agronomic benefits, let's put in other crops, whether it's avocado or, you know, herbs or whatever else it is, you are starting to bring about biodiversity, and you're starting to look at the how to move away from, even over time, synthetic fertilizers, because you're starting to sort of fixate the nitrogen. But that can't be done at an individual farmer level, especially not when a smallholder farmer may well have quarter acre, half acre, 1 acre, under their own management. So I think, again, one of these disruptive, but one of the sort of disruptive ways of looking at this is, let's focus on this at a catchment area. And ultimately, that would roll up to a national level. But let's start with each sort of area servicing an existing factory and say, okay, what is the optimal way of growing tea, and let's use all the nature-based solutions we have at our fingertips to make that happen.
If yields per hectare in Kenya are lowered, how do you generate sufficient monthly income during the harvest and receive an annual bonus to sustain the farm?
So I think, first of all, there has to be more distribution of value. I think the producers in Kenya may consider themselves to be shortchanged if you think about the entire value chain. And this goes back to my point at the start that, the buyers, the retailers, they're all absolutely adamant that they're doing the most they possibly can. Well, if that were the case, then people, the consumers, wherever they are in the world, should perhaps start accepting that they need to pay more for their tea and more for food generally. I think for a very long time, food has been incredibly cheap. We haven't put a value to nature, to the environment, to the soil, to the water. And I think once you start pricing all of this in, and once you start pricing in all the things that you expect the producers to do, quote unquote, for free today, you might find that actually the cost of tea is much higher than you realize. And so I think that's the first thing. How do we redistribute value? The second is factories in Kenya that are not always making the best decisions in terms of their own sort of balance sheet, right? So I hear about factories that put in a third or a fourth line for CTC processing. Or I hear about somebody saying, okay, well, orthodox is fashionable, so let's look at orthodox. And even west of the Rift Valley, I was having a conversation with somebody very senior in the Kenyan tea producing ecosystem who said, oh, but if we free up land and our farmers start growing food crops, there are very few urban centers in Western Kenya. And I thought, well, where is that food going to go when Kenya already imports food? And clearly we'd have to have a much longer conversation over what would be the best crops to grow. But I do think that there needs to be a bit more cohesion in terms of, where should these alternative crops be grown? Where are the markets? And actually, fundamentally, where is the demand? Right. Today, I keep hearing about people saying, okay, let's start growing XYZ crop, which might be avocado. It might be blueberries. It might be, that's all great, but who's going to consume them? You know, Kenya grew its production of tea. It increased by 50% in a decade. Did Kenya actually think about who was drinking that tea? Who was actually going to be drinking that? Was there a demand for it? So I do think that along with the distribution of value, there has to be much more focus on consumer demand. Even in Kenya, if you were to turn around and get people to drink quality tea, as opposed to just throwing a few tea leaves into very milky water with lots of sugar in it, you've got your work cut out for you, but that doesn't mean you shouldn't start. It is possible to change habits. It takes time. So let's do this, right? We're not going to get everybody wanting, a specialty cup of tea overnight. But I also don't think that shouldn't stop us from going down that journey. And again, going back to how do you attract a new generation of people into the tea sector, I think that's also a way of doing it. It can start in many different places. But let's take tourism as an example, because I think Kenya has a sizable tourism sector for both international and domestic. And I think that the hotels, the lodges, the campsites, I mean, that for me would be a fantastic place to not just to serve tea at breakfast and lunch and in between but bring about this whole experience around tea and introduce tea tasting where the visitors are, right? And that wouldn't be so very hard to do. I mean, I think if you invest in having a tea sommelier, somebody who really understands the tea that they're serving, let's also accept that, there is room for it all. I think promoting and serving some of, the best Kenyan teas should absolutely be encouraged. But also telling people, the typical cup of tea in the Highlands is, you harvest the rainwater, you get fresh milk from the cow, so you milk the cow, and then you throw some leaves and you make it very sweet. And here's a shot of it so that you understand what people drink, in other parts of the country. And by the way, that description I've just given you is literally how I drank my first cup of tea in Dakaini when I went to visit my in-laws. That it was pouring with rain. We did take harvested rainwater and the cow was milked in front of me. And they laughed when they heard that I didn't take sugar. So I think it's creating a certain sort of experience around this would be important. Secondly, government offices. Government is a significant employer in Kenya. And again, we receive visitors from around the world. Well, I do think that if you're walking into any ministry, you should have the right to have a decent cup of tea. It should be a right. it shouldn't just be an expectation. And actually, when I do go to the Tea Board of Kenya or when I go to KTDA or any sort of tea producer in Kenya, I actually do look forward to drinking the tea. But that's it. If I go to any conference or any other sort of office, including government office in Kenya, I'm served with this sort of thermos of tea that has been made without sort of any sort of thought or discrimination. So I think that both tourism and government could become much better ambassadors for the tea that is served. And that would start going quite a long way. Kenya has a lot of conferences, by the way, just global conferences. And having 20 people instead of two or three big, those big things, dispensers of hot water and actually having people serving tea and engaging people in the breaks and saying that, come and enjoy some of our finest. That's being an ambassador for some of the excellent produce that you can get in Kenya.
Intrigued by what you heard in today's podcast? Would you like to learn more from our global network of Tea Biz journalists and tea experts? Remember to visit the Tea Biz website for more comprehensive coverage. That's www.t-biz.com. Thanks for listening. Farewell till next week.
Produced by Atavita Studios. Connect your voice to the world.